I do admit that my presentations of Lincoln, with his magnanimity as the central trait, told only part of the Lincoln story. The prior and central fact about President Lincoln is that he did his duty as a statesman.
Good morning. How many times have we celebrated at least the first half of President's Day on Election Day? Has everybody here voted? Please do. The whole nation is watching Virginia today. Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our guest today is a very special friend of the Miller Center, William Lee Miller. Bill Miller's new book is President Lincoln, The Duty of a Statesman. And there will be a signing following the forum. Bill Miller, as many of you know, has had a long and deep association with the Miller Center and with the University of Virginia. For many years, he has been the Miller Center Scholar in Ethics and Institutions. Before that, he was the Thomas C. Sorensen Professor of Political and Social Thought. He was chairman of the Department of Rhetoric and Communications. And before that, he was a professor of religious studies. Bill Miller has taught at Indiana, at Smith College, and at Yale, where he earned both his bachelor's and his doctorate degrees. Reading the Bill Miller shelf in anyone's library would yield a very comprehensive and deep understanding about America's founders, her struggle with religion, with slavery, with ethics, and with contemporary politics. He is the author of 11 books, some of which he asked me not to discuss because they're old and out of print. But ones that I've particularly enjoyed are Yankee from Georgia, The Emergence of Jimmy Carter, Arguing About Slavery, The Great Debate in the United States Congress, which is a very surprising book. It tells a chapter of American history that most people don't know about, and that is the arguments in the 40s and the 50s, 1800s, 40s and 50s, about slavery that preceded the Civil War. And most recently, Lincoln's Virtues, which is now 7 years old. His new book, President Lincoln, The Duty of a Statesman, is a History Book Club main selection. It is a selection of the Military Book Club, and he has just been notified that it is a Book of the Month Club February main selection. So that's hitting the trifecta. Please welcome Bill Miller.
Thank you, George. I would try to express my gratitude, my deep gratitude, to the Miller Center, but if I did that, I would cut into my own time for the speech. I have a deep and long affection for and gratitude to the Miller Center. When I first started working on Lincoln, I gave talks on the second inaugural with its remarkable generosity and profundity. I talked about Lincoln's magnanimity, his being, as his friend Leonard Swett said, a very poor hater. I noted that in spite of his role in a world of ambition, conflict, and power, Lincoln did not hold grudges. I told the whole story of how after Edwin Stanton had humiliated him in a law case in the old days, and in his presidential days had called him an imbecile and a gorilla, Lincoln overlooked all that and appointed Stanton, who became his great Secretary of War. I went through the collected works and checked off all the Union soldiers sentenced to be shot to death with musketry, as the phrase had it in the courts martial, whose life Lincoln saved with pardons. I noted Lincoln's eloquent letters of condolence, like the famous one to Mrs. Bixby that I understand is on display at the World Trade Center. I talked about the remarkable absence of hatred or vindictiveness in this war leader. In his career, the word amnesty was not a word of reproach. After one talk of this sort, I gave many of these here, there are several of these here at the Miller Center, and after one of them, a Miller Center regular, a former government official, came up to me and said, "You know, you always present the benign Lincoln." That gave me pause. Another experience may have had some of the same effect. On the turbulent day when a memorial to Abraham Lincoln was dedicated in the capital of the Confederacy, a large story in itself that day was, three of us were invited to give talks in the morning before the dedication at the Virginia Historical Association. Mine was once again about the second inaugural and the magnanimous Lincoln. A conservative writer for the Weekly Standard, who was covering the furor over the monument, heard us talk in the morning. When he wrote it up, he said disdainfully that we liberals seemed to believe that if Lincoln had been born 125 years later, he could have been Bill Moyers. That evening, when Richmond's leading Lincoln-hating neo-Confederate asked this conservative writer what we had all said in the morning about Lincoln, the conservative writer answered, "They said Lincoln was a wimp." The neo-Confederate sneering response was, "Jesus, I don't think he was a wimp." Well, I don't think he was a wimp either. I say he was so far from being a wimp that he did not have to do macho things in order to avoid being called one. But I do admit that my presentations of Lincoln, with his magnanimity as the central trait, although true and important, as far as they went, told only part of the Lincoln story. The prior and central fact about President Lincoln is that he did his duty as a statesman. And that certainly required the unbenign, unwimpish assertion of purpose, use of coercive force, together with a long list of bold irregularities. I had invented for the earlier book the category in the subtitle, An Ethical Biography. The new book is an extension of that ethical biography into the unique moral situation of a president of the United States. The title of the earlier book, as George said, had been Lincoln's Virtues. A wit said, "My next book should be Lincoln's Vices," but I offer this instead, President Lincoln, the Duty of a Statesman. For Lincoln, taking the oath was not just routine. It was a transforming event. Next January 20th, a new person will take the oath as President of the United States, the 44th president, and the moment when he or she takes the oath may be saturated in historical meaning. Nevertheless, that moment will not have the existential immediacy the oath had for Lincoln, because in his case, the nation he was swearing to preserve, protect, and defend was literally in need of preservation, protection, and defense. The echo of Lincoln's oath would sound across the 30,000 citizens standing in front of the East Portico, and then, as we may say, across the ages. The tableau on the Capitol steps that day made quite a tidy capsule of American history. Picture it. Here's Chief Justice Roger Taney, the author of the Dred Scott decision denying that the black persons had any rights that the white persons need to respect, administering the oath to Abraham Lincoln, who will write the Emancipation Proclamation. Taney thought the oath he was administering to Lincoln prohibited this executive from coercing states to remain in the Union. Lincoln thought the oath administered to him by Taney required him to do so. Then came day one. You've heard of day one. Well, Abraham Lincoln had a day one that made the day one of all other presidents seem like a day at the beach. He was slapped in the face the first minute of his presidency, first business minute, by the necessity of decision of the gravest sort. He had absolutely no honeymoon. He was told right away that the garrison at Fort Sumter was running short of provisions and that the rebels had now fortified the harbor so that it would take 20,000 good and well-disciplined men to rescue them. The United States Army at the time Lincoln became president had fewer than 17,000 men, and they were scattered in little groups all over the West. Now, Lincoln had to decide on the first day what to do. The candidates today talk a good deal about who is experienced and not experienced. By the measure of formal positions held, Lincoln was at that moment the least experienced president in American history. Of course, as a novice, what he should do was to consult the experts. His military chief, the great old General Winfield Scott, gave the obvious advice: abandon the fort. His chief civilian advisor, Secretary of State William Seward, gave the same advice: by all means, abandon Fort Sumter. But this new president, for all his inexperience, on his first day, said no. He admitted that militarily, abandoning Sumter was plainly indicated. But he said politically, it would be a disaster. Lincoln wrote about it: in fact, it would be our national destruction consummated. This could not be allowed. One of the unwimpish characteristics of Abraham Lincoln as president was his stark and unblinking recognition of the stakes in the rebellion. A first requirement of moral decision for a statesman, actually for anybody, is to define the situation accurately. Accurately as to facts, accurately as to values. In Lincoln's understanding, a victory by the rebels would not be merely what some people thought it could be, a graceful severing of ties, the erring sisters curtsying and gently departing, and that while the Union then, slightly diminished, would go waltzing on as before. Not for Lincoln. For him, a rebel victory would be instead the surrender of the existence of the government. It would be the ruin of our country. And for whom would that be a disaster? For the whole family of man. If the rebellion succeeded, it would show to the whole world that Republican government did not work. We recite the Gettysburg Address without quite realizing the radical claim it includes. This war is testing whether not just this nation, but any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are determining whether government of, by, and for the people shall perish from the earth. If the first requirement of worthy statecraft was to see with clear-eyed objectivity the reality that the nation faced, the next requirement of worthy statecraft was to decide and to act on that perception, not to dither, procrastinate, evade responsibility, or pass the buck. Lincoln's predecessor, James Buchanan, when confronted with the rebellion in seven states after Lincoln's election the previous November, said that no state had a right to secede, but he then covered over any response with a blanket of hesitations. Seward had given a witty summary of President Buchanan's position as expressed in his speeches. "I think the president has conclusively proved two things," said Seward of Buchanan. "First, that no state has the right to secede from the Union unless it wishes to. And second, that it is the president's duty to enforce the laws unless somebody opposes him." That would not be Lincoln's position. Where Buchanan sought avoidance and found restriction and therefore excuse, this new president would accept responsibility and find necessity and therefore empowerment. But what then to do? He faced a most exacting perplexity, the tightest of tight spots. On the one hand, he had taken an oath to preserve the Union and made a solemn promise to hold, occupy, and possess the property belonging to the government, of which Fort Sumter had become the essential symbol. He couldn't let Sumter go. On the other hand, he'd made a promise in his inaugural not to initiate armed conflict, and that promise was reinforced by political reality. If he took overt military action, that would look to the wavering border states like the coercion that they condemned and drive them over to the rebellion. Lincoln is always quoted as having said, "I would like to have God on my side, but I must have Kentucky." So good we all quote it, even though Lincoln probably didn't really say that. To lose Kentucky, Missouri, Maryland was to lose the conflict. So what to do? Between his inauguration and the fall of Fort Sumter, Lincoln lived 1,000 years. In the midst of that intensity, he came up with a masterful idea. It had two parts inextricably connected. First, the garrison needed bread, then send salt pork only, bread only, no arms, and notify the South Carolinians ahead of time that that was what he was doing. He said, "The giving of bread to the few brave but starving men of the garrison was all that would be attempted." On second thought, on editing this, he thought starving might be overdoing it, so he struck starving and put hungry. He wanted the world to know that the expedition was bringing bread only, and firing on it would be firing on hungry men. So whereas he had faced a dilemma, now the rebels faced one. When they fired the first shot on the American flag at Fort Sumter and reduced the fort, Lincoln led a united nation against the rebellion. Altogether new to the highest level of national decision-making, indeed to executive responsibility of any kind, wearied by the pressure of reporters and visiting politicians in Springfield, and by an exacting trip from Springfield to Washington, embarrassed by a dark of night skulking entrance into the capital city, exhausted by 10 crowded pre-inauguration days in the Willard Hotel, stunned by an altogether unexpected bombshell of a message in his first minute of presidency, harassed in every working hour and some non-working hours by long lines of office seekers outside his door, the novice President Abraham Lincoln gathered himself across the days of March and the first week of April to make the weightiest turning point decisions in the history of the American Republic since the founding. Lincoln described his momentous decisions and the moral ground for them. "It became necessary for me to choose whether, using only the existing means which Congress had provided, I should let the government fall at once into ruin, or whether, availing myself of the broader powers conferred by the Constitution in cases of insurrection, I would make an effort to save it with all its blessings for the present age and for posterity." Later presidents inclined to the imperial presidency invoke Lincoln as a model, as an excuse, but there are three decisive distinctions between Lincoln and these later appeals. First, the threat that Lincoln faced was unique. No other president has faced a mortal threat to the very existence of the nation. Second, he dealt with an emergency of a type the Constitution does explicitly recognize, an insurrection which no other president has faced. And third, he never claimed to have a presidential authority going beyond that of Congress. Lincoln would say that his actions were ventured upon under what appears to be a public demand and public necessity, trusting that Congress would ratify them, and Congress did. What actions did he take? He created an army. As we said, when he was inaugurated, there were fewer than 17,000 men in the United States Army. 4 years later, when he was shot, there were more than 1 million, and more than 2 million had served. He took strong actions to keep Maryland in the Union. He exercised sensitive restraint to keep Kentucky in the Union. He supported a virtual coup d'etat to keep Missouri in the Union. He blinked at irregularities to chop off a piece of Virginia to make a new Union-supporting state. He would show a thoroughly unwimpish resilience after the shock of that first defeat at Bull Run and on many dark days thereafter. In one dark moment in the summer of 1862, he would produce this sentence, remarkable alike for its moral rigor, its literary grace, and its lawyerly covering of all contingencies. I expect to maintain this contest until successful, or till I die, or am conquered, or my term expires, or Congress or the country forsakes me. When you measure Lincoln on your wimpometer, the arrow goes far over to the strong side. And yet, Lincoln's strength of will is not like that of the strong men that those who sneer at so-called wimps may admire. Lincoln's strong, purposive action was not of the Napoleonic sort, the overt assertion of a proud ego, or the Machiavellian sort, the swaggering joy in shrewd dominating. In Lincoln, not ego or pride or bravado or sheer willfulness, but strength of mind and powerful sense of duty were the groundings of strength of will. Because it rested on reason and the stability of truth, Lincoln's strength of purpose included the ability to admit mistakes and to correct them. When Grant's elaborate plan to take Vicksburg had finally succeeded, Grant's civilian commander took the trouble to write him, "I now wish to make personal acknowledgement that you were right and I was wrong." How many strong leaders would write and send that sentence? After I tell the often told story of Lincoln's mastery in the Fort Sumter case, I tell the seldom told story of his lack of mastery in the parallel case having to do with Fort Pickens and a missent warship, a royal screw-up in the Lincoln administration that was partly Lincoln's fault, for which he took more of the blame than he deserved and learned from and did not repeat. The grounding in reason and duty, rather than ego, meant that Lincoln could be resolute without being ruthless. He could exercise great power without fulfilling Lord Acton's famous dictum. He could combine generosity with his steadfast resolve. The boldness of Lincoln's boldest act, his decision to use the war power to free the slaves in the rebel states, is sometimes not recognized by modern interpreters. When a reader today begins to read the Emancipation Proclamation, he may have a puzzled feeling that he's got the wrong piece of paper. This document is certainly no Gettysburg Address. It begins with whereas and is replete with lawyers' words like thereof and hereby and wherein and whereof and hereafter and heretofore and to wit. And it draws legalistic boundaries. This great edict of freedom frees slaves in Baton Rouge, but not in New Orleans. Frees them in Richmond and Alexandria, but not in Norfolk. Proclaims that freedom shall reign up to the border of Berkeley County, Virginia, but not across that border. A modern reader may be further puzzled because the proclamation really does not seem to do much proclaiming. Where is the Lincoln who started his rise in politics proclaiming that slavery was a monstrous injustice? The answer is that Lincoln is fully present, not in the words of the document, but in the decision of the man who issued it. The Emancipation Proclamation sounds like a legal document because it is a legal document. It does not have the lift of moral argument because it is not making a moral argument. He was not giving inspiration, he was giving an order. The tedious specificity was central to Lincoln's justification. As a military chief calling upon the war power he could command on his own authority, the freeing of slaves and slaves in rebellion as a necessary military measure, he could not do that in states and areas not in rebellion. When we return to the second inaugural, we are brought back to the other great Lincoln theme, the golden thread of magnanimity, of generosity, of charity that is woven throughout the whole of his presidency and his life. And the second inaugural combines the themes of Lincoln's life and presidency as a way we may be able to explain a little in the questions that follow. In the reception after the second inauguration, Frederick Douglass managed, despite the racial barriers, to get in to see Lincoln. And Lincoln, shaking his hand, insisted on exchanging a word with him and said, tell me what you think of my address. Douglass said, you don't want to do that, know that. Yes, I do. Mr. President, it was a sacred effort. That's it.
Move to the back of the room and ask those who have questions to meet me in the back and throw them to you. Let me start with a question that I think is on everybody's mind today. Lincoln is perhaps the most studied and the most revered of our presidents, and many people feel that because of the divisiveness that we have experienced in this country over the last so many years, that the incoming president will face a crisis of the spirit that is not comparable to the crisis of war that Lincoln faced, but nonetheless a significant crisis. There needs to be healing. What would you ask that the new incoming president in 2009 do? What lessons would you hope that the incoming president would take from Lincoln?
Lincoln, well, you're asking me a contemporary politics board, but what were the qualities of Lincoln that you would want in a new president? First of all, he was very intelligent. I'm not sure, given all the other things that are said about Lincoln and the way he appears in advertisements and the way his image is used all over the place, I'm not sure the broad public quite appreciates that this was a very strong mind. If you'll sit with a book of his letters and his speeches and read them through, you'll see. He had a very strong memory. He had a very clear logical power. That was combined, as I tried to say, with a very strong conscience, a sense of duty. And that then was linked to the nature of this country in a very broad way. That a new president should be something like Lincoln would be too much to be desired, maybe, but if it could happen, it would be wonderful. I'll work on that answer when I get home, make a better one.
Enjoyed your talk. very revealing of a president that I guess I should know more about than I do. I have an observation and then a question. The observation is some of the things that you said about President Lincoln and what drove him in those early years, that first year particularly, it sounds just a little bit like some of the things that John McCain has been saying lately. We cannot fail. This is a noble cause. We cannot afford to have other nations doubt that we are resolved to do these things. Now, that's a bit of a stretch, perhaps, but I'd be interested in whether there's any comparison at all. And the other question that I have really is, if Mr. Lincoln were president today, would he be a Midwest isolationist in terms of his view of the world?
It's always hard to answer, to take the second first, it's always hard to answer these questions that jump clear across all the intervening decades, century. One of my favorite answer to somebody asking a question, what would Lincoln do, was a late distinguished Lincoln scholar, was once asked in the height of the issues about racial busing, what would Lincoln do about racial busing? And the scholar paused a while and he said, he would say, "What's a bus?" That's a little bit my answer to the, you know, trying to squeeze all these qualities from the mid-19th century. The first part of that question, though, I can say something. Yes, there are comparisons. The question is between McCain and others, other people in war situations who say we must persist, and you could find plenty of quotations from Lincoln about not giving up and persisting. And we started this war for an object, and we will end it when that object is attained. So you could do that. The question is, do you agree that the war in question now is anything like an equivalent to the Civil War in the United States? My answer is no. This is a gulf between the wars. So there's Lincoln in the business about his will. Getting it right, but it isn't right yet, about the distinct qualities of Lincoln's will. His early hero is Henry Clay, and he has a passage in his eulogy of Clay about how Clay had an indomitable will, but then he also had, it's almost like it's out of current politics, he also had good judgment. And then he said, such a will without good judgment is some kind of stubbornness. What was the will? Some pejorative about sheer stubbornness. So you have to decide whether the persistence is justified by the object.
My question gets to a point in Lincoln's life earlier than that, Dr. Miller. I would like your estimation of what gave him, what formed him at such an early point in his life that he could transcend the bickering within the cabinet or different views that he could listen, that he developed this capacity to be so sure of himself. When we think back to him as a young man, perhaps on the river running a rafting company and doing the things he did in his very early years, what would you identify as the formative aspects for him, his formative experiences?
He read a lot. The books he read are of enormous importance. His mother, his natural mother, died when he was 9. She is reported to have been a person of quite distinguished qualities. We don't know really anything about her except a reputation, a positive reputation. But we do know that then this youngster in the Hoosier Woods read everything he could get his hands on, and it was good stuff. The deprivation of being way out there had the ironic effect that pretty good stuff. You know, it was the King James Bible, and it was books of readings that had Shakespeare and had Addison and Steele, and he read that and took it in. That clearly was very important to him. And then that's culture, nature. He was born a man with a good mind and with a conscientious streak in him.
Yes, I'm wondering, given threats on Lincoln's life even before his first inauguration, in selecting Andrew Johnson as a vice president, did he play much of a role in that, and did he give much thought to whether Johnson would have the same generosity of spirit that he had?
That was a big mistake. It was a mistake made by the, as it became then, Union Party, the Republican Party, getting ready for the 64 election. Lincoln should have played a role to stop it. That's one of, when people ask me to list Lincoln's mistakes, that's one of the most, because Johnson turned out to be a big mistake. So that Lincoln being assassinated, Frederick Douglass said, was a catastrophe for the black citizens of the United States. I say it was a catastrophe for the whole country, and the whole the events afterward were Andrew Johnson, and it's not a good president.
Another issue that's of course always brought up is the question of suspending habeas corpus, which took place. Could you comment on that a little bit and give us your assessment of the pros and cons of that?
Yes. When he suspended habeas corpus, as he did in those early, first did in those early days, and trying to get, just imagine the President of the United States worried about the fall of the capital city itself and being cut off so that you couldn't get messengers, you couldn't get trains in, you couldn't get the troops in from the north. The troops that marched through Baltimore then there was a riot to prevent them coming. And Lincoln pacing there saying, "What? When will they come? When will they come?" When he could protect the Secretary of War of the Confederacy is predicting that the Confederate flag would fly over Washington by May 1st. In that setting, he suspended habeas corpus along the route to Washington from the north, where you had all kinds of things going on that you do in a civil war. His justification for that and the later expansion of that as we got to the Emancipation Proclamation was what I read to you. What I've done, I did expecting that the Congress would ratify it, and they did. The Constitution does provide for the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus in situations of insurrection and invasion. And Lincoln saying this, this is the case, the emergency in which you need to do that. And you read through the people who were arrested in Mark Neely's good book, The Fate of Liberty, if you know the history about this, about Vallandigham, the famous case, most of them aren't like that. They aren't people just who were speech makers who were opposing the war. The Copperheads did a lot of that. But there were people who were recruiting for the Confederates, who were blowing up bridges, who were, you imagine the nation at war with, in many families, as you know, brother going one way and another brother the other. So you had a very unusual situation. And I think Lincoln's justification stands up. And then I gave the three arguments in my speech about why that can't be applied in the case. I don't think it can be applied in most other presidential cases.
Could you also comment on Lincoln's writing, method of writing, and writing his speeches and composition?
I recommend a book by a man who is named Wilson. You were anticipating Doug Wilson, a book called Lincoln's Sword. Lincoln's Sword, his pen. As I say, maybe the mythic, legendary, popular Lincoln that's all around us in Rosarum commercials and so forth, all kinds of things. You don't get his mind. You don't get the fact that he was a really able writer. Trained himself to be. In his youth, he gave these florid speeches like a bad Daniel Webster, but he got over that, and he tightened it up, and he got a very good sense of both of words and of rhythm of his writing. And again, if you read him, you know his great speeches, but read his letters. You see a writer of distinction in everything he touched. He'll come up with, let me see if I can quote the great sentence that he wrote to Francis, to Hackett, the actor who played Falstaff and who took a letter that Lincoln wrote to him had it reprinted and passed around, and critical newspapers seized on it and sneered at Lincoln. He thinks he's a Shakespeare critic now. Lincoln wrote back to Hackett and said, I should have practiced reciting this, see if I can say it. I didn't think that this letter of mine was, I thought it was private, I didn't think it was going to be public, but never mind. Give yourself no uneasiness on that count. I have experienced much ridicule without much malice and a great deal of kindness, not altogether free of ridicule. Ridicule in both. That's a wonderful sentence that I may have botched, but this balanced sentence, it's morally impressive as well as being literarily impressive, that he tossed off in this letter to this guy who's done what he shouldn't have done, and Lincoln didn't hold a grudge and said that sentence. But he's aware that, you know, there's an element of comedy in people's, you know, he's tall, his arms hang way down, he's got this, some people said ugly, other people said, oh, you're not so ugly, but, you know, and his voice, you know, when he got up to speak at Cooper's Union, he said, Mr. Chairman, and there was some kind of Hoosier twang there that people thought, and so he was mocked a lot. And he said, well, I'm used to it, you know, I've had a lot of ridicule, but pretty tame, so I can take it.
I wonder if this was the first time in American history when it was vitally important that the Constitution say that the president will be the commander-in-chief, and secondly, to what extent is a good judge of men a good substitute for a military experience?
I didn't quite understand the second one. Maybe I'll take the...
Did Abraham Lincoln use a good judgment of men as a substitute for a lack of military experience?
Yes, well, he came to do so. That's one of the things that people go over with. He'd never fired anybody. He'd not been the head of anything except a two-man law firm, executive, when he got to be president. But then he had a whole string. If you go through the Army of the Potomac, you go McDowell and McClellan and Hooker and Burnside and Hooker and so forth. And looks like he's firing one general after another. He does keep searching for Grant, who comes to be the answer to things. Grant and Sherman come to be the answer at the end, and it takes a while to find them. Of course, the United States hadn't been fighting wars. We didn't have a big military with a lot of people with training, particularly not people who led the giant armies that are now talking about. Nobody in the Mexican War had an army as big as the army that marched off to Bull Run on the first battle. But while Lincoln is looking for the commanders, he's also reading typical Lincoln. He goes to the Library of Congress. He gets books about military strategy. And although he's very deferential in many of his letters, read his letters to generals. That's just a little unit itself for class in Lincoln. He's deferential. He says, you know about this, and I don't. At the same time, he's reading, and he says things that are prude. You know, he says to McClellan, look, I can figure out, you know, come on, let's do it this way. He both as to the general things and as to the quite specifics, he can manage both generalizations and particulars. And he therefore could be, there's a book by an Englishman that says the military genius of Abraham Lincoln, as it used to be argued back and forth a bit, that he because of qualities of mind and application, he became good at that.
On the question of slavery and emancipation, we know that Lincoln was quite cautious in the election of 1860 and as the war began, too, but eventually he came through. Do you think he could have been more progressive on that issue earlier, or did he handle it just about right?
I think he handled it about right, and I want to underline that he did so. I mean, here's this society that's a slaveholding society. It has this giant institution of human slavery, and people today have a hard time thinking themselves back into that situation where that was actually a huge reality, economically, for one thing. Think of all the family fortunes that are bound up in owning slaves. You know, you got 4 million slaves. You got nobody's given me the percentage of the GDP. You didn't talk about those, but how much, but it was a very big part of the economy. And so Lincoln comes to be president. He's got to hold Kentucky, he's got to hold Maryland, he's got to go Missouri, he's got to hold all the people in the North who don't believe slavery is an evil, who do believe we should hold the Union together. So his politics is to manage that. And the people who now say, oh, he had a pen right away, could have signed. No, to sign it, to try to, by the war power, free all the slaves in, immediately on being elected would have been a catastrophe. And it would not have been a benefit to the slaves if the Union had collapsed. In other words, handling the politics of the situation was as important to the slaves' future as was the Emancipation Proclamation and then the 13th Amendment. So that he timed it about right. Even when he did it, which is before the congressional elections of 1862, as a critic might say, you're going to lose a lot of votes. He did. The Republicans did less well in the congressional elections of 1862. The Democrats used against the Republicans both in that election and then against Lincoln himself in 64. The fact that he's made this a war to free slaves. We didn't join up to free any slaves. We joined up to save the Union and attacking him for that. So the timing was about right when you had awareness enough in the public that this was a longer war than anybody had bargained for, that there was this continuing resistance, and at the same and that this and he could justify it on the grounds sheerly of military necessity. I didn't get to read my sentence. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation was an enormous moral accomplishment that could about which he could not say it was a moral accomplishment. It was essential that he not say, we're freeing slaves because slavery is evil. No, no, he didn't say that. He said, we're freeing slaves because that removes this big force from the rebel side and moves it over to our side. And you can measure that the way you can measure steam power. It's power, that, and that's what I'm doing as Commander-in-Chief, war power, and I'm trying to win the war.
Would you comment on the religious dimension of Lincoln's perspective, particularly when he says the Almighty has his own purposes, that this gives a transcendent dimension to his view without falling into fatalism?
You said it well already. the second inaugural is beyond all competition, the finest religious expression by an American president. It is soaked in what Lincoln came to in toward the end of the war in his thinking profoundly about religious matters. The Almighty has his own purposes is a key sentence in the second inaugural, which the questioner quoted. Imagine a war leader about to win the war who says both sides, they prayed to the same God, neither side attained what it really thought it was going to attain. The Almighty has his own purposes. And then I wish I could quote the next, not the last paragraph, which is a great paragraph, the one you know the first phrases of, with malice toward none, with charity for all. That paragraph is a single sentence. You know, do your look at it and you'll see. And the predicate of that single sentence is, let us strive on to finish the work we are in. So the finishing is still there. We're gonna do this. But it's also this deep condemnation of slavery or awareness of God's condemnation of slavery in the next to last paragraph. Read the sentences that begin, fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if it should continue until every drop of blood drawn by the lash should be matched by one drawn by the sword, still it must be said, as it was said 3,000 years ago, the judgments of the Lord are just and righteous altogether. It's a tremendous paragraph, and then you get with charity for all, with malice toward none, and the healing things in the last paragraph. Lincoln never joined a church. He'd go with Mary to these Presbyterian churches and sit with her. He talked some with various preachers. He read some. He didn't have a New Testament. He had Shakespeare that he carried around with him. But he thought, I have said sometimes that he bypassed conventional religiosity, and he had a profounder understanding of the Christian religion than many people who are church members. Most people, let's say.
This kind of goes off the last question, but you mentioned that Lincoln grew up reading the Bible and other texts. Would you say that his rejection of slavery was more so based in the biblical truths or other reasoning that he picked up from other readings?
Well, certainly both. I mean, the Declaration of Independence is very important to him. He said, every political thought I have is there in the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence means the second paragraph. It means really the one phrase, all men are created equal. That's really an enlightenment, a rational enlightenment source of condemnation of slavery. But he also condemned it on religious grounds in the second inaugural. Surprised I could quote as much as I did. Let's see if I can do it again. All knew that this interest, slavery, was somehow the cause of the war. I love the Lincoln of the somehow. Because, you know, I'm not saying you slaveholders caused the war. He's saying all knew that slavery was somehow the cause of the war. It is hard to believe that any man should fight when he grinds out in the sweat of the brow of another. But let us judge not that we be not judged, to use the phrase from Matthew that includes that. I didn't get that sentence right. But, you know, a little blip of religious condemnation of slavery, but then let us judge not that we be not judged.
I didn't catch what you meant by the attitude of Lincoln toward the formation of West Virginia in 1863?
Well, that's a complicated story, which I was rolling along and staying within 27 minutes. I in the new book, I do go into that. What Lincoln knew, Lincoln gets to be president. It's all very well to say I have all my sentiments come from the Declaration of Independence and the almost chosen people, the kinds of things he says as he's coming to be president. Then he gets to be president, and he's not reading the Declaration of Independence. He's reading a map. I mean, maybe reading both. But he's got to look at the map to see. And he sees this arc of country beginning in Delaware and moving across. And these western counties of Virginia are an important part of it. And then Kentucky. And then across the river to Missouri, and including Maryland. There's an arc there of the upper South border, which he's got to keep from going over to the rebellion. And the western counties of Virginia are a very important part of that. The sentiment there is anti-slavery and pro-union. When the delegates come into Richmond and they're looked down upon by the Eastern Shore people and so forth, and they go back and they know what side they're on. Well, all he wanted was to have a union control of those counties, but the people there wanted to split, cut off from those folks over, you know, the ones they were looked down upon by were the Virginians over there on the other side of the mountains. So they took the initiative. Now the trick was one of the irregularities was Virginia has to consent to slicing off a chunk to become a new state. But who is Virginia? And the Confederate Virginia, no. They form a group of Union supporting Virginians who then vote. And I think it was Bates, his own attorney general. It was Henry Wise, the governor, one sometime governor of Virginia, says it's a bastard child of a political rape. And Lincoln didn't say this, but don't say that I said he said this,
But he acted as though to say, yes, but it's our bastard. At that point, you know, having that be Union country was enormously important to him. And if it also then went all the way to making it a state, okay.
Bill Miller, you have written some of the most interesting work on Lincoln. If someone, after having read both of your recent books on Lincoln, wanted to read two other books in order to understand both the wimp side and the man of steel side, what books would you recommend?
Well, the standard thing that people say is David Donald's one-volume biography. You get into the world like this and you begin to have little criticisms and differences and so forth, and that wouldn't be a very interesting suggestion. It'd be an obvious one. Douglas Wilson's Lincoln's Sword is a new book that's not going to cover, it's only Lincoln as a writer, but that's a very important part of it. I would recommend that. I'd recommend an older book, Benjamin Quarles, Lincoln and the Negro, which is a good corrective for some of the stuff that you get now about Lincoln and African American world. There are two. I could, of course, go on.
Bill Miller is going to sign copies of President Lincoln, The Duty of a Statesman. And so let me ask everyone if you would please remain in your seats to allow Bill Miller to exit the room. Thank you very much.